From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo is in Russia today meeting with President Vladimir Putin and Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov. They're talking about a number of issues, but front and center today is Iran. There's reporting in the New York Times that the Trump administration has been considering sending more than 100,000 troops to the Middle East. And President Trump today denied that, saying, quote, would I do that? Absolutely. But we have not planned for that. The Secretary of State was asked about it in Russia.
We're looking for Iran to behave like a normal country. And that's our ask. And we have applied pressure to the leadership of the Islamic Republic of Iran to achieve that. We fundamentally do not seek a war with Iran.
NPR diplomatic correspondent Michelle Kellerman joins us now from the State Department. Michelle, first of all, what do you make of this talk today from a lot of places about Iran?
Well, you know, Secretary Pompeo has been trying to drum up concern about Iran. He's been talking about these Iranian threats, and he said sort of cryptically today, we have concerns about actions Iran is taking or potentially taking. But he was there meeting with Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov, the Russian foreign minister, and the Russian foreign minister has been really raising concerns about the U.S. and Iran kind of stumbling into conflict. He said that he hopes that these rumors about these military planning is just that, rumors. And I should say that Pompeo heard similar concerns when he dropped in on a meeting in Brussels yesterday on the same subject.
Well, and we remember that Russia is still in the Iran nuclear deal with a number of other countries. Sergei Lavrov was asked about Iran today and U.S. rhetoric on Iran. Here's what he said.
We spoke on ensuring the peaceful nature of Iranian nuclear program. We have many differences here, but the fact that we talk on this topic and will continue to discuss this situation, that gives us hope that certain agreements could be reached.
The Russians have a lot at stake here, too, on this issue of Iran.
Yeah, and they don't agree with the U.S. position of reimposing all of these sanctions that had been suspended under the Iran nuclear deal. As you mentioned, the Russians are still in that deal. So, too, are the Chinese and the Europeans. It's only the U.S. that pulled out.
Venezuela also came up today. Pompeo reiterated that it is time for the president, Nicolas Maduro, to go. That's the U.S. position. Russia disagrees with that. What did they say?
That's right. It's another one of these cases. Sergei Lavrov said that this is something for Venezuelans to negotiate. And he reminded reporters of two other recent times that the U.S. said it was trying to impose democracy, Libya and Iraq. And he said, look how that turned out. And that was sort of the way this whole news conference went today. Both Lavrov and Pompeo said that their presidents really want to improve relations. They want to turn a new page. But when you went down the list, there were very few areas where they could really agree.
Well, one of the areas that has not come up in the high profile talks between President Trump and President Putin is the Russian interference in the election. A lot of people wondering why the president hasn't been stronger on that when he's face to face with Putin. But in today's case, Pompeo did talk about Russian interference. Here he is.
I made clear to Foreign Minister Lavrov, as we've made clear for the past months, that interference in American elections is unacceptable. If the Russians were to engage in that in 2020, it would put our relationship in an even worse place than it has been, and encourage them not to do that, that we would not tolerate that.
What about that, Michelle?
Yeah, I mean, he was pretty adamant about that. And then Lavrov came back and said, I gave Pompeo a 1987 article that suggested that the Soviets were trying to interfere in U.S. elections. He also brought up a long history of the U.S. influencing politics in Russia. So, again, they were talking past each other. And Lavrov says, until there are cold, hard facts, as he put it, the two sides are not going to be able to have a grown-up conversation about this.
Did it seem, just in the few seconds we have left, different than other meetings between the U.S. and Russia to you?
Well, both men said they really wanted to get past this era and said that their presidents want to get past this era. But at the moment, they're just exchanging these talking points that are put them on the opposite sides of most issues.
NPR diplomatic correspondent Michelle Kellerman, thank you.
Thank you.
Well, to domestic politics now. Democrats in the House plan to vote this week on 7 health care related bills aimed at pushing back on the Trump administration's efforts to undo the Affordable Care Act or Obamacare. Separately, last week, President Trump came out with new rules requiring that drug prices be listed in drug ads on TV, and he spoke in favor of reining in surprise medical bills that can run in the tens of thousands of dollars for people with good coverage. Let's get caught up with Julie Rovner, Chief Washington Correspondent for Kaiser Health News. Hi, Julie.
Thanks for having me.
Well, the Democrats' push on health care. It began last week with that vote to ban Trump administration rules that grant some states waivers from complying with Obamacare. Now, Republicans say those waivers are a way for states to lower prices by letting insurers come up with cheaper plans. Democrats say only healthy people will move to that cheap insurance, leaving those with pre-existing conditions in an Obamacare with fewer participants, so higher premiums. What is the chance of Democrats being able, with these new bills, to ban those waivers?
Probably not very good. The Senate almost certainly won't take this up. And even if it did, the president wouldn't sign it because it would be outlawing his own administration's rules. And that's true of a number of the bills that the House is going to pass this week. But the Democrats in the House want to make the point that they are trying not just to shore up the Affordable Care Act, but to undo some of the damage they say the president has done with some of these rules. The bills that are going to be on the House floor this week would do things like restoring funding for people who help people sign up for plans and outlawing the expansion that the Trump administration allowed of short-term plans that don't offer comprehensive benefits. Now, they have packaged these with some bipartisan drug price bills, which is leaving Republicans in kind of an awkward situation. There's a lot of Republican support for some of the other bills in this package that would make it easier for generics to come to market by basically eliminating some of the tactics that brand name drug companies use to prevent generic companies from getting a hold of their products.
Well, it's interesting. You point out that the bills do include this money to let people know about Obamacare and the sign-up times, because that was a huge problem in the past when that funding was cut.
Yeah, it was. And people weren't aware, although surprisingly, almost as many people signed up for Affordable Care Act coverage this year as last year. And this year, there isn't even the requirement that people have insurance. But yes, the Democrats would like to put that money back.
Well, just to be clear, Julie Rovner, what is the definitive word on how people feel about having this comprehensive health care, things like coverage for pre-existing conditions, Obamacare?
Well, Obamacare is doing better in the polls. What we're really seeing is that people with employer insurance, sometimes insurance they don't even have to pay for, are being frustrated by increasing costs. They're being asked to pay more in deductibles. They're being asked to pay more in their copayments. They feel like, you know, they have this insurance and they can't afford to use it. And that's becoming a bigger and bigger issue, both for Democrats and Republicans.
Huh. And just to, again, be clear, these bills that the Democrats are putting forth have nothing to do with what some of the presidential candidates are talking about, which is a full government insurance plan, Medicare for all. This is just about reinforcing and bringing back some of the requirements around Obamacare.
That's right.
Yeah. I want to move on to surprise medical billing. You and NPR and Sarah Cliff at Vox have been reporting on this astonishing cost that some people have, these surprise bills that people have been getting. You and NPR tracked the story of Drew Calver of Austin, Texas. He spoke at President Trump's news conference last week about a heart attack he suffered 2 years ago.
Although I had insurance, I was still billed $110,000. All that stress and the fact that it was highly inflated, I was in shock when I found out some of the real prices, stuff I was charged for. So I feel like I was exploited at my most vulnerable time in my life, just having suffered a heart attack.
Well, Julie, first of all, don't you think this is a case of journalism actually moving policy?
Yes, absolutely. And I should say it's not me personally, but yeah, Kaiser Health News as an organization in this project with NPR. But obviously lawmakers, both Republicans and Democrats, now think that there really needs to be legislation so that this kind of thing doesn't happen to other people when they go to what they believe to be an in-network facility and they get these enormous out-of-network bills.
Is that how this happens? These stories have been astonishing, $110,000.
That's right. Well, in this particular case, it was an out-of-network facility, but it was also an emergency. He had a heart heart attack. People try to play by the rules. There are things that they can't know, like, you know, whether the lab at the in-network hospital is also in-network, or whether the doctors that are brought in are in-network, particularly in emergency situations. And everybody agrees, I mean, the industry, the Republicans, Democrats, President Trump, that this shouldn't be the case. What they're having trouble agreeing on is how to fix it and who should pay.
Okay, no legislation written there yet, but it looks like there will be. And just quickly, what do you think the effect will be of President Trump's push to have drug makers specify list prices for prescriptions on their TV ads?
Well, I think the hope is that it will shame drug companies into lowering their prices. But there are some who are concerned that it will just confuse customers because very few people pay the list price. And there are even some who say that maybe if people see these really high prices, they'll think that means it's a better drug and they'll want it. Mm. So we'll have to see how this plays out.
Julie Rovner, Chief Washington Correspondent for Kaiser Health News. Julie, thank you.
Thank you.
There's a new book out today that argues that the financial practices of the baby boomers have put their millennial children's economic future in serious jeopardy. It's called The Theft of a Decade and was written by Wall Street Journal writer Joseph Sternberg. He joins us now. And Joseph Sternberg, the decade you refer to in the title is the one following the global financial crisis of 2007-2008. Why do you focus on that decade in particular?
Well, I think that was a very important decade for this millennial generation because it really coincides with the period when the largest number of us were coming online economically. You know, when we were finishing up our college education, when we were just in the very early years of our careers, and we were doing that during a period when the economy was unusually bad. I mean, we were seeing a lot of economic conditions that America hadn't experienced since the Depression in the 1930s. It wasn't quite that bad, but it was certainly much more serious than a lot of the recessions that America had experienced, particularly when the boomers were coming of age. That has had a really profound implication for millennials' prospects. That if you lose that first decade when you are supposed to really be getting your economic feet, it becomes very difficult for you to try to claw your way back from it.
Mm-hmm. Especially when the job market you're looking at is very different. We talk all about the gig economy, like it's this futuristic, great new way that people can work as much or as little as they want. But really what the gig economy, as you point out in this book, is a way to spend as little as possible on labor while getting as many profits as you can if you're a company right now.
Right. I had started out thinking that this was only going to be a book about the past decade. And what I realized is that the story needed to start a little earlier than that in order to make sense of what has really happened to the millennials. Really, the way that, you know, America was doing job creation has been misfiring in some ways for decades. There were a lot of things that were going wrong in terms of the way, you know, we were incentivizing various investments, the way we were thinking about productivity, the way we were thinking about what the job market should look like in the future, and the policy choices that the boomers were making about that. And, you know, an example of that is that a lot of the natural incentives that existed in the economy in the 50s and 60s when the boomers were children for companies to really invest in productivity enhancements that would drive wage creation, a lot of that had started to dry up and you had this drought of new investment in a lot of corners of the American economy in that decade after 2008 that I think had the effect of cutting off a lot of job opportunities for millennials who otherwise might have been able to move into some of those areas.
The crash of 2008, of course, was precipitated by the housing crash. And you bring up housing in this book as an example of how baby boomers stole the millennials' economic future.
Yeah, and the housing is such an interesting example of all of this. The dominant story for much of the boomers' early adulthood in the 70s and 80s were these big efforts in Washington to try to encourage more homeownership. And by the 90s, that was really working in terms of the percentage of people who owned the homes that they lived in. But it had come at the expense of a lot of policies from Washington that were really encouraging a lot of irresponsible home lending and irresponsible home borrowing. And, you know, as we know, that created a lot of problems in the financial system that resulted in this 2008 crash. And yet after that, the boomer solution was, again, to try to focus on propping up property prices, to try to keep as many boomers in their homes as possible without really thinking about what some of the generational consequences of that would mean. I mean, what would it mean to millennials who were entering into early adulthood, starting to reach the point in their lives where they should have been jumping onto the property ladder, and yet they couldn't because the boomers, for the purpose of trying to recover from this financial crisis, were really trying to do a lot of policies to prop up the property market, to keep prices high, to solve this problem that, you know, the previous round of housing policies had created.
And rather than selling their houses at a certain point in their lives, you point out they decided to tap into their houses and get some of that equity out to spend now.
Exactly. The whole way that America came to think about housing and housing wealth under the boomers' watch, I think, is a real problem from a generational perspective, because I think that there really is the sense that people should try to hang on in their homes as long as possible, that there shouldn't be this natural life cycle of downsizing once the kids are out of the house. And that, of course, opens up inventory that growing families can buy. Boomers also have been very successful at tamping down on new home construction in parts of the country that have been economically vibrant, where the millennials should be looking for jobs, and yet once they find that job, they can't afford to buy a house with it.
You know, you bring up something that I didn't even think about when it comes to boomers and millennials, which is inheritance and the fact that, you know, the boomers have built up a lot of wealth, and you would think that that would eventually be passed on to the millennials. But the fact that the boomers are living for so much longer than previous generations means that it may be too late by the time they pass on that wealth.
Well, it's funny you mention that, because that's an issue that I stumbled across as I was researching the book that I hadn't really thought about that much before. This is often presented as an example of how the millennials actually don't have it so bad. This argument that, yeah, sure, the boomers have accumulated all of this housing wealth, the boomers have enjoyed all of these other benefits that accrue from, you know, career stability earlier in their working lives mm-hmm. than millennials have enjoyed. But it will work out in the end because the boomers will end up passing that on to their children. Yet I actually think that it's kind of the opposite. That's not a good news story for millennials, because you are going to then run into this issue where the boomers will live a lot longer than previous generations. They'll do it in worse health. So you have this first order question of how much of an inheritance boom will actually be available for millennials. And then you also have this issue that do we want to live in an economy where your economic security is based on whether or not your parents have managed to accumulate enough wealth that they can pass it on to you. You know, America used to think of itself as a society where actually, I mean, inheritance did play a role in some families, but there was also the sense that there would be opportunities for people for whom inheritance was not an option.
Anybody can make it in America.
Exactly. And I think that we should be really curious about why it is, and we should be worried about why it is that suddenly, you know, that might not be the case for the younger generation, that there are a lot of reasons to worry that millennials are being cut off from some of the opportunities, especially in terms of the job market and the ability to develop stable careers over time that used to be the pathway to economic stability for earlier generations.
What about people who would look at this and say, they're not a selfish generation. In fact, they've given a lot to the future. You know, boomers would think of themselves as those who you know, gave us all of the liberal policies of the 1960s, et cetera. What do you say to people who say, look, the boomers aren't so bad?
Well, I'm not saying that they are evil people. I think that the theft of a decade that I'm talking about in my book is less to do with malevolence and just more to do with a failure to really understand what was going on around them and to respond appropriately to that. A tendency to stick to a bunch of assumptions that might have worked for the boomers when they were younger and that did help to deliver a period of remarkable prosperity for America. I mean, if you look at the technological advances that we benefit right down to the smartphones that we're all walking around with, if you look at the diversity of job openings for certain millennials that are out there, you know, if you look at that kind of millennial, you can think you guys don't really have anything to complain about. Actually, we do, because it is true that the boomers created a very secure and comfortable today for their millennial children. But where I think they really ran into trouble was thinking about long-term security for millennials. And that's the discussion that we need to have now.
What made you start to think about the generations, when you were looking at some of the problems in society today and you said, I'm going to write a book about what the boomers did here?
Well, it had an interesting backstory because, I mean, one of my nerdier interests as a journalist has always been issues like monetary policy, fiscal policy. And I was thinking about that one day and I realized, there are actually a lot of generational implications to so many of these policy decisions that we just don't think about because we aren't used to thinking about a lot of these policy issues in generational terms. And coupled with that thought, I began to be really interested in whether there might be something to some of these millennial complaints. I was curious to know more about, were the boomers or were the millennials right about this basic question of how hard done by millennials have been in this economy? And I was surprised to end up in a place where I thought that actually both sides are right. It can be true that millennials have never had it so good, and it can also be true at the same time that millennials still face a lot of problems that more recent generations didn't.
You're joining us today from London. Do you think there's a difference in the millennial versus boomer divide in the UK, or at least outside of the United States, as inside the United States?
Well, one of the things that I find interesting, but also very troubling, if you stop to think about it, is that these problems surface all over the world. And you can look at generational issues in developing economies like China, India. A lot of generational issues are really going to come to the fore in places like Africa over the next 20 to 30 years, because you do have very large young generations of millennials there who are going to need to find their way in a rapidly changing developing economy. But in more mature countries like the US, like the UK, where I live right now, across Europe and Japan, what you discover is a lot of societies that have these economic problems for young adults that haven't been able to come up with a good solution. That suggests that really there is something that we need to be thinking about in general, that it isn't a matter that some countries are getting it right or some countries are getting it wrong. I think that the whole system seems to be set up in ways that these problems are emerging, and we need to be really curious about why that is.
That is Joseph Sternberg, whose new book is called The Theft of a Decade, How the Baby Boomers Stole the Millennials' Economic Future. Joseph, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
And we've got an excerpt from the book at hereandnow.org. You can also leave your thoughts there, hereandnow.org.
This message comes from Here and Now's sponsor, Ember Wave. Ember Wave, the revolutionary new personal thermostat that is designed to help you find thermal wellness in any situation. Ember Wave can put you in control of your comfort in places like your freezing office, uncomfortable airplanes, cold restaurants, after a workout, at home, and more. Named one of Time Magazine's best inventions of 2018. Learn more at emberwave.com. Ember Wave, balance through temperature.
For 30 years, musicians from the Washington, D.C. area have gathered every Saturday to play the blues. In the past decade, they met in a little building by the railroad tracks in Maryland. But that shop lost its lease, and the group needed a new home. WAMU's Michaela Lafrac sat in on their last jam.
There are a lot of places to go see great musicians in the D.C. area, but none are as devoted to acoustic blues as Archie Edwards Barbershop. The group's headquarters is a dingy, wood-paneled room that feels kind of like a clubhouse for adults. There's a bunch of mismatched chairs, an old fridge full of soda and beer, and a deer head mounted on the wall. About 24 musicians filter in and start tuning their instruments. They don't play for an audience, just for themselves, and whatever passersby happen to pop in. Mystery train. The group's name comes from its founder. Archie Edwards was a great blues guitarist who ran a barbershop in D.C. Every Saturday, he'd invite blues musicians to come jam with him.
He was great. And I was like, oh, wow, I'm going to be like that when I grow up.
Miles Spicer is a guitarist who used to hang around the barbershop in the late 90s and early 2000s.
And being the neophyte that I was, it was just a humbling experience. He was that good. Well, now we're running with it.
The It he's referring to is this weekly jam. Edwards died in 1998, but his friends and admirers have kept the tradition alive. They mostly play acoustic Piedmont blues, a type of syncopated blues that's flourished in this region. The musicians are young and old, black and white, talented and not. People take turns playing solos on everything from harmonica to bones, a percussion instrument. After they play a few songs, the group's president, Willie Liebel, explains why they lost their lease.
The zoning got changed to high-density housing here, and so there's going to be some, townhouses and condos. So we kind of saw the writing on the wall, but we just ignored it as long as we could.
He says he has no hard feelings towards the developers. This is just what happens.
And it was just through luck and, I guess, slow development that we stayed here so long. I know something's going to turn up.
Other group members, like guitarist Judy Evans, aren't feeling as zen about it.
Oh, it's sad. We've been here 10 years. And when I started coming here, it was a transition time in my life with a sick parent I was caring for. And so, I have an attachment to this physical space.
She says she's trying to have faith the group will pick up in a new spot soon.
It's just a wonderful community. And it's like the blues. It's, your heart and soul.
One of the things the group will miss most about this building is how you can hear the trains rumble by. There are lots of great blues songs about trains. Liebel leads the group in one last one.
Come back to the station, train is going outside, mystery train.
Nearby, Archie Edwards' old green barber's chair sits empty in the corner. The group saved it when the shop closed, and they plan to bring it with them to wherever they land next. For Here and Now, I'm Michaela LaFrac.
And this update, after months of searching, the Archie Edwards blues musicians have just moved into a new home. WhatsApp users are being advised to upgrade to the latest version of the messaging program after reports of spyware monitoring people's calls. This is just the latest challenge for WhatsApp owner Facebook, but in his recent reasoned blistering op-ed, Facebook co-founder Chris Hughes made it plain. Facebook shouldn't have been able to acquire WhatsApp and now should be forced to drop it and Instagram. While expressing affection for his old doormate Mark Zuckerberg, Chris Hughes, who left the company years ago, says Facebook is a monopoly. It either crushes competition or copies it, stifling innovation, and it captures users. There was that delete Facebook movement after it was revealed that the Steve Bannon-backed Cambridge Analytica took users' data from Facebook. But people who wanted to leave had nowhere to go. Hughes says at one time in history, Facebook would have been broken up and should be now. And that while that feels un-American now, it's because of a concerted effort by conservative free marketers over the past 40 years to convince us it's un-American. Hughes says, in fact, the country's founders would have embraced it. Jared Bernstein was an economic advisor in the Obama administration and is now senior fellow at the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities. Jared, I don't even know. Did you think Facebook should be broken up?
I didn't think so before I read his article, but I found the argument extremely muscular. There was so much written about the piece that I sort of felt like I'd read it without reading it, and then I sat down and read it. And when I did so, I was just blown away by just how strong and coherent and convincing and muscular that argument was. And I'm largely convinced. I think there's an alternative of much more heavy regulation, but either way, a lot more needs to be done to rein in their power.
He said the founders not only created checks and balances for government, but they did for business. Jefferson and Madison read Adam Smith, who believed that big monopolies prevent competition that spurs innovation. Hughes quotes the Ohio Republican John Sherman in the late 1890s saying on the floor of Congress, "If we will not endure a king as a political power, we should not endure a king over the production, transportation, and sale of any of the necessities of life." He was talking about railroads in particular and talking about the cost to consumers. In other words, if you only have one behemoth. You can't shop around. And so the Sherman Antitrust Act of 1890 outlawed those monopolies. But how do you find one? Because, as we said, Hughes says Facebook either buys up or copies companies that compete. It's worth $500 billion, commands more than 80% of the world's social networking revenue, blocks other companies. Vine, the Twitter video network, couldn't use a tool for users to search for Facebook friends. It soon failed. In 2016, Mark Zuckerberg told Facebook workers, don't be too proud to copy. And they did copy Snapchat. It sounds like the original monopoly busting was because, you know, it meant consumers had to pay too much. Facebook is free.
This is a really key insight. Today's monopolies are not necessarily manipulating us on prices. They're not jamming up the prices in the industries they concern. Of course, you just said Facebook is free, but you could think of Amazon in the same light. I mean, people go there because prices are low, not because they're using their monopoly power to raise prices. So you have to look at something else, and that something else is market share or market power and the other distortions that incurs. So in the case of Facebook, we have the well-known problems we had in the last election. But if you simply look at the share of the market that they dominate, or for that matter, the share of the market that you can find specific companies dominating in everything from hardware to retail to pharmacies to even mattresses and beer, you're going to find that same problem. It's not necessarily the kind of price distortions that our original antitrust laws were targeting.
Well, the breakup of AT&T and IBM in the 1980s was about companies using size to stifle innovation and crush competition. And by the way, AT&T, as part of that breakup, was prohibited from going into what was then a very young computer industry. And Hughes says that's why there was competition for coming up with that computer industry. If there hadn't been, we might not be where we are today. But what about this idea that he says that Facebook also has a monopoly on our thinking because it does control so much of what we see and read and say?
Well, I think, again, Facebook is unique in that regard. And in fact, one of the things that I wonder about in terms of Hughes's suggestion to break Facebook up is whether actually breaking them up would do the trick. Because imagine you had three or four or five smaller Facebooks, at least on paper, but the majority of the users all gravitated towards one because these are all about networking, network effects. Mm. Well, if you have everybody pretty much on one platform, even if you have 20 platforms, you still have the same problem. So while breaking up Facebook might be a partial solution, there's no way around this outside of some much more serious government regulation. And thus far, and Hughes was very clear about this, Congress has completely abrogated its role in that regard.
Well, but he does make the point that if you broke up Facebook, you might have competition, because right now investors won't even invest in other companies because they know that Facebook, you know, might gobble it up.
Well, let me respond to that. Yes, you might have competition, but you also, just by dint of the nature of social networking, you might have everybody just land, or not everybody, but, you know, 80, 90% of the users land on one platform, and you'd be back where you started. All I'm saying is that breaking up is probably just a partial solution.
Yeah. Well, but he does make the point that if there was a breakup and other companies had a chance, you might have a company that pledged to better privacy, or you might mm-hmm. have a company that pledged to better screening of the information that came in and pledged to some kind of an oversight of what they allowed in. I mean, he tells the story of how Mark Zuckerberg heard that there were people calling for genocide through Facebook in Myanmar. And he said, I'm going to block those calls. I'm going to block those posts. And as Chris Hughes said, that's great. But what if it's something else that Mark Zuckerberg alone, mm-hmm. one person decides to block? I mean, are we comfortable with that? He says, you know, we're not paying with money, but we may be paying in other ways. Just remind us, Jared Bernstein, how did we get here? How did it happen that this idea that government could and should step in when there's a monopoly became un-American? He writes about a movement starting in the 1970s.
Yeah, Chris is exactly right about that. And it's a critical point. We got here because the notion of laissez-faire economics, essentially leaving corporations alone to grow as big and powerful as they want, was sold as integral to an efficient economy, that the damage done from regulating the size or power of corporations would be far worse to the economy's performance, efficiency, output than keeping them down to size. And as you correctly pointed out earlier, Robin, that's new thinking. If you go back to earlier periods in American economic history, it wasn't something that Democrats and Republicans fought about. There was a very common view, as you said, dating back to Adam Smith, that this kind of dominant corporate power had to be checked because to do so actually was positive for the economy. It would actually promote innovation, productivity, the economic dynamism where small firms that had some special attribute were able to grow in an environment that they weren't crushed by a dominant firm within the industry. This was well understood by economists, but we forgot about that because, in fact, the forces who benefit from corporate concentration basically started to dominate the argument in the 1970s by essentially buying up the intellectual architecture of those arguments and convincing everyone that taking action against corporate power was destructive when, in fact, the opposite can be the case.
Jared Bernstein, before we let you go, again, senior fellow at the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities, an economist through and through, I'm taken by your saying that Chris Hughes' extensive piece, which we will link to and I urge everybody to read, kind of changed your mind. Is there a conversation going on with economists because of this?
Very much so. The notion that we had to reform our antitrust laws to push back on corporate power is not something that you'd find sessions about in economic conferences going back 10 years. Now it's commonly understood to be an important market distortion that we have to address. I think the thing that economists had to get over was to stop looking solely at price and look at other aspects, holding down wages, using their corporate power in political ways. We've had to broaden our scope, and I think it's much more broadly recognized. And I think one bit of evidence for this is not just from the economists, but if you look at the politics, I suspect that pretty much every one of those 20-plus people running for office on the Democratic side are going to have antitrust reform in their platforms. And that gets back precisely to the argument that Chris is making.
Jared Bernstein, Senior Fellow at the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities. Thanks so much.
My pleasure, Robin.
So, break up Facebook, or is the horse out of the barn? The Trojan horse, maybe, in this case. Thoughts welcome, hereandnow.org.
The Democratic field of presidential hopefuls is expanding. Montana Governor Steve Bullock announced today that he is running for president, making him the 22nd Democratic candidate seeking the party's nomination.
This is the fight of our time. It's been the fight of my career. I'm Steve Bullock, and I'm running for president. With your help, we will take our democracy back.
Later this week, Bullock is expected to head to Iowa, home to the country's first presidential election caucus. And that's where we find O.K. Henderson, news director for Radio Iowa. Kay, thanks for joining us.
Thanks.
So as Steve Bullock gets into this race, he's the 22nd candidate on the Democratic side. What case is he going to make in Iowa? Or what void is there that's ready for him to fill?
He's going to make the case that he has been the chief executive of a state that people in the Western United States make decisions in a different way. They're less confrontational. They're more collaborative. That's the message he's been sending Iowans since he's been coming out here for the past several months. He made several trips here in 2018. And when he gets here later this week, he will have beside him Iowa's long-serving Attorney General Tom Miller, who will be endorsing him.
But how is he going to go up against somebody like Joe Biden, who's now at the top of the pack in all the polls across the country?
That's the key question for, you know, many of these 20-some candidates who've announced. How will they make the case that they are more electable in the long term as opposed to the former vice president? You certainly have sort of a two-tier system developing out here. You have Biden, you have Sanders, who's well-known, And you have Senator Elizabeth Warren, who's been percolating up the polls. You have Cory Booker, the New Jersey senator, who has a strong on-the-ground team here in Iowa. So it's going to be difficult for someone like a Montana governor, Steve Bullock, to make a dent here, especially since he's entering so late in this contest.
You didn't mention Kamala Harris there. Why not?
She has, I think, a different strategy. I think that she's hoping to do well enough to go on to New Hampshire and then really make her mark in South Carolina. And then, of course, there's been all this talk about Californians are going to start voting by absentee the day of the Iowa caucuses. So I think she's also banking on the idea that she can do well in her home state.
And what about Pete Buttigieg, who's gotten a lot of press coverage over the last several weeks?
He certainly has. He's made a couple of trips to the state of Iowa. He is lagging behind some of his competitors, even those who aren't in the top ranks of any poll in terms of people on the ground here. And he has acknowledged that he needs to sort of ramp up his game and hire some people who can spread his message when he is not here to do it himself.
Okay, and then there's Beto O'Rourke, who just finished a five-day tour all over Iowa. Here he is last week responding to an emotional teen who asked him what he'd do as president about school shootings.
These are our three concrete steps, from universal background checks to banning weapons of war sold into our communities to red flag laws that can begin to save more lives and make sure that you come into school not worrying about whether you're going to encounter an active shooter.
How's he doing in Iowa?
He's doing okay. I don't think he's doing as well as some might have expected given his high-profile Senate race in Texas. But he has acknowledged that he needs to come here and do more work on the ground. He has a strong team in place in Iowa, and he's coming back to the state to campaign next week. And in terms of that issue that you just raised, that's one of the interesting things as you listen to these candidates engage with voters. That's often a question that's asked often by young people who are attending these events. How can you make it safe for me to be in school?
What are the other big issues for Iowa voters right now, Kay?
Many of them are being asked about climate change, but underlying many of these issues is this percolating idea of how will you face off against Donald Trump in the general election? How will you carry the Democratic banner, if you will? So electability, whatever that means to any individual voter, is really top of mind here.
And how does Bernie do on that score, Bernie Sanders?
He certainly has a core of supporters here who supported him in 2016. He hasn't been as aggressive here in terms of personally campaigning as some of the other candidates have been. He does have a strong campaign team on the ground. I think he's trying to hold on to that core of supporters that he had in the last caucuses and perhaps challenge the former vice president here for maybe a 1-2 finish.
Have Iowa voters gotten to the point where they're sick of all this yet, or is it still pretty exciting to have all the candidates around?
You know, people are really into it. And that's been one of the interesting factors as I cover these campaigns around the state and the candidates. Many of the people who are seeing one candidate are seeing 10. So they are really, really engaged in this campaign.
That is OK Henderson, news director at Radio Iowa. Thanks so much, as always.
Thank you.
They're seeing 10, but that means there are still 12 others on the Democratic side that they haven't seen.
Slackers.
Here Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here Now.